Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there a tab that says articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm not a regular blogger, but when things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study.
We continue our exposition of 1 Samuel in the Old Testament. We've come to 1 Samuel chapter 11. Saul has just been coronated by Samuel as the first king of Israel, that is, human king. Up to now, God had been Israel's invisible king and remained so, but they had rebelled against the Lord and they wanted to follow the custom of men and have a human monarch reigning over them. For his own purposes, God had acceded to their, not request, but their demand. It wasn't wrong for them to have a human king. God had planned that all along, but their motives, as I've explained again and again, were entirely wrong. They felt more secure in the hands of a human regent than they did their divine and invisible sovereign. Well, now Saul has been publicly coronated. He has gone back to his home in Gibeah. Of course, there's no government apparatus. There are no government buildings. So it's a primitive kingship at best, though now Saul does have something of a royal retinue. We saw in verse 26 of the previous chapter, Saul also went to his house at Gibeah, and valued men whose hearts God had touched went with him. Though there was a dissenting element, certain worthless men said, "How come this man deliver us?" And they despised him, and they did not bring him any present. But Saul kept silent. Now we're going to see what I call the debut of an unnatural leader. Here we see the unseen hand of God in human events. Now Nahash, the Ammonite, came up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead, which was on the east side of the Jordan River. The siege of this city by the Ammonites is going to give Saul a military coming-out party. All the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, their enemy, they appealed to him, "Make a covenant with us and we will serve you. We'll become your slaves," is the bottom line. But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, "Yeah, I'll make it with you on this condition." And a savage and brutal condition it was. "The condition is that I'll gouge out the right eye of every one of you. Thus I will make it a reproach on all of Israel." Well, the elders of Jabesh said to him, "Well, give us a little space. Let us alone for 7 days that we may send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. Then if there is no one to deliver us, we will come out to you." Well, why would he consent to such a condition? We'll get to that later. Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul, because Saul is now their newly appointed king. They spoke these words in the hearing of all the people, and the people lifted up their voices, and they wept at the prospect of this horror. Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen. He was still, you might say, a part-time king, still a gentleman farmer. And he said, what's the matter with the people that they're weeping, because this is quite a sound of lamentation. So it was related to him the words of the men of Jabesh. Well, now at this time, the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. And he took a yoke of oxen, he cut them in pieces, he sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, and this was quite a threat, but it was needed, whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so it shall be done to his oxen. Then the dread of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came out as one man, and he numbered them in Bezek, and found that there were 300,000 of the sons of Israel and 30,000 of the men of Judah. They said to the messengers who had come, go tell the men of Jabesh Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance. So the messengers went, told the men of Jabesh, gave them the good news, and they were glad. The men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will come out to you. That's what they said now to Nahash, the king of Ammon, and you may do for us whatever seems good to you. All of this is a ruse. It came about the next morning that Saul put the people in three companies. And here's the trick. They came into the midst of the camp at the morning watch, caught them by total surprise, struck down the Ammonites until the heat of day, till about noon, and it came about that those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. Then the people said to Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Do you remember those guys that disrespected the king when he was coronated and didn't bring you? Go get him. Bring the men that we may put them to death. But Saul said, No, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished this deliverance for Israel. Then Samuel said to the people, come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. Renew it. This is not the coronation of Saul, this is the renewal. Now that Saul has accomplished his great military feat in the defeat of Nahash, now it seems time to get the people really invested in his kingship, now that he has proven himself as a military leader, by virtue of the Spirit of God coming mightily upon him and helping him. So all the people went to Gilgal. There they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they also offered sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. You know, the FBI does psychological profiling of various kinds of criminals by studying the backgrounds and behaviors of known felons. From all that they glean, they're pretty much able, with often uncanny accuracy, as you know, to put together a psychological profile of criminals whom they've not yet identified. In the same way, the Bible helps us understand the ways of God by its narratives that recount how God has worked in the past, this being one. By familiarity with historical records like this in 1 Samuel chapter 11, we're able to grow in our understanding of the way God's unseen hand works in human events, so that we might be encouraged in some things, that we might be warned in other things, and enlightened by all, so that we learn to live within God's will. Behind all human events and human beings is the hand and the purposes of our unseen God, ruling and overruling, enabling and disabling, delivering and destroying according to his own good pleasure. That God who has appeared to us in the face and the person of our Lord Jesus Christ. Embedded in this account of Saul's first official act as the king of Israel are several illustrations of the timeless ways and power of God, folks, to direct and influence human affairs and to affect his purposes. And it ought to encourage and enlighten all of us. Here's the historical context. There was a long-standing grudge held by the Ammonite rulers over territorial rights on the east bank of the Jordan. Does this sound familiar? You see it back in the book of Judges. It's referred to in connection with Jephthah's conquest of the Ammonites. That came about because the Ammonites challenged Israel's claim of territory east of the Jordan River. They claimed that territory had been taken from them during the latter days of Israel's wilderness wandering. Now Nahash is trying to reclaim that disputed territory. And that's what this Ammonite threat to the Israelite city of Jabesh in Gilead is all about. The male leaders of the east bank city of Jabesh were really prepared to capitulate or surrender their fortified cities and to submit themselves as slaves to Nahash, this cruel Ammonite ruler. And no wonder, they figured they were not strong enough to hold out under a siege, and if they lost after a siege, they would all be slaughtered. In the end, they would all be killed when their resistance forced their opponent to waste so many lives and so much time and resources overcoming them. That was the way, the law of war in ancient times. So they figured, that is, the people of Jabesh and Gilead, they figured it would be the wiser course of action to accept the inevitability of their defeat and to submit to serve the Ammonites as their slave rather than to die cruel deaths and to subject their wives and children to all the horrors they would face should the Ammonites conquer them by force. And they were pretty sure they would be able to because they did not have the counterforce to throw them back. So they ask in return for their surrender that the besieger would offer them terms that would salvage self-respect as well as assure their preservation. Well, the treaty that Nahash the Ammonite offered was brutal enough, but it was better than the alternative they figured. He would spare them if they laid down their arms, came out, and he was allowed to gouge out the right eye of all the citizens of Jabesh. Again, savage as the conditions were, they sure beat the alternative. Well, you might ask, what purpose did this eye-gouging cruelty serve? Well, one was clearly, as we see in verse 2, to humiliate their enemies by disfiguring them. Another was to degrade their capacity to wage war in the future. That was what Nahash had in mind. A man can fight with one eye, but in hand-to-hand combat of ancient warfare, two eyes served an opponent better than one, you can believe. Yet this form of maiming, while it degraded their military effectiveness to some degree, left them still able-bodied enough as slaves for the Ammonites. So there's your motive. In verse 3, the elders of Israel of Jabesh-Gilead asked for 7 days to make up their minds and to see if they could persuade anyone to come to their rescue. If not, then they would surrender to the inevitable. And if you ask, why would the Ammonites agree to that proposal? Well, here are the reasons. Conducting siege warfare was a costly proposition in terms of lives, time, and resources. If there was a chance, and there was a good one, that the Jabesh-Gileadites would throw in the towel at the end of 7 days, it was worth suspending military operations for a week. For two, they knew from history that help for the people of Jabesh was most unlikely. But even if it did show up, it would probably not pose any great threat to the Ammonites, but would only furnish Nahash an opportunity to magnify his victory, enhance his reputation, and enrich the booty that the Ammonites would reap. So they figured they had everything to gain and nothing to lose. Well, now that Israel had a king who was supposed to lead his army out to protect cities and the borders of his realm, the desperate Jabesh-Gileadites naturally appealed to Saul, their newly crowned monarch, to help them. Now, this was really a reach, for as yet, as we have seen, Saul was little more than a king in name only. His birth home was really all the castle, so to speak, that he had. There was no capital, there was no court, there were no courtiers. He had some attendants, but there was no standing army, no treasury, no bureaucracy. Virtually nothing was in place except a man with a royal title and a retinue of brave-hearted men, whose hearts, we saw in verse 26 of the last chapter, had touched and prompted them to follow him and surround him as a kind of royal bodyguard. Now, here all of a sudden, the new king is faced with his first military challenge. The Philistines were by far the most formidable foes that Saul would face during his reign. But from the east side of the Jordan, there was this encroachment of the Ammonites and the testing of the will and power of this new king, which Nahash, if he knew about Saul at all, and probably did, would have no reason to fear, but every reason to take advantage of, should Saul try to rally the people to fight. Well, the people wept aloud in despair at the report from across the Jordan. Here they had wanted a visible king to go out and fight their battles for them, and all of a sudden, they seemed to realize that in rejecting God, they hadn't bought what they had paid for. Suddenly, their king seemed like an ant facing an elephant, and they despaired of the plight of their brethren on the other side of the river. So here we see what I call the debut of an unnatural leader. Let's talk about that a little. Saul has the physical stature that accorded well with their notions of a warrior king. But hey, folks, that was about all. When we first met this man out in the hills of Ephraim and Benjamin, searching for some long-eared asses which had wandered off, his servant at that time seemed more like a leader than Saul. When he met Samuel, it was Samuel who came across as the leader, not Saul. Saul seems to be little more than an onlooker, uncomprehending of what's happening to him. On his way home from his encounter with the prophet, when the Spirit of God comes upon him, he temporarily prophesies. Those who witnessed the strange phenomenon seem to look upon Saul with bemusement and a sense of bathos. That means things gone from the sublime to the ridiculous. And finally, when Saul shows up at the assembly called by Samuel to select the king by lot, to identify publicly the one that God has chosen and to confirm that choice by that lot process, we find Saul too self-conscious and timid or reserved to show his face in public. He's hiding behind the baggage, trying to hide himself and more or less resisting going front and center. But down underneath was a change, a divinely wrought change that had not worked itself to the surface yet. Kind of like the change we see in some children. Right now, they do not appear to have the attributes that will later manifest themselves. What is embedded in their personalities and characters has not yet blossomed, but at some point these things begin to germinate and then to blossom, and so it was with Saul. In chapter 10, the man Samuel appoints as king is no natural leader. He looked the part physically, but so far in life he had never played the part, nor was he programmed for the part. The guy needed a personality overhaul. God had to take a man who looked the part of a king on the outside and rewire him on the inside so that at the right time, circumstances would catalyze the leadership endowments now latent in him by divine provision. So God gave his personality leadership wings, so to speak, and here the Spirit of God comes upon Saul and enables him to fly to a whole new height of functionality in this Ammonite threat. So in verse 5, the emissaries from Jabesh-Gilead arrive at Saul's home in Gibeah. They find him engaged in agriculture. He was returning from the fields with a team of oxen when he found the townspeople in distress and weeping. Well, Saul naturally inquires what was the cause of the grief, and they reported to him the plight of the people of Jabesh-Gilead. At that moment, the Spirit of God, verse 6, came powerfully upon Saul, seizing upon the personality change that he had wrought in Saul some weeks before. The Spirit of God stirred up a sense of moral outrage in Saul, which sparked the flame of that leader personality that God had planted latently in Saul earlier. This began the debut of a leader created not by nature or nurture, but by miracle. In verse 7, with royal decisiveness, heretofore vacant in his personality, he directed his men to send a royal communique post-haste to all the tribes of Israel to report immediately for military duty. They were to muster at a place called Bezek. In the urgency of the situation, Saul didn't ask or beg for volunteers. He issued his first royal edict with great firmness. Knowing that old habits die hard and that the tribes of Israel for some generations now, under more or less district judges, could be rather contrary and an independent lot and decide for themselves what battles seemed to be in their interest and which were not, and who they could leave hanging out to dry as they saw fit, he let the tribes of Israel know in no uncertain terms that there was a new sheriff in town and that the days of doing whatever they pleased were over. To make his point graphically, he cut up his team of oxen, carved them up like a good butcher, sent the bloody parts to all the public places in Israel, warning thereby any who were inclined to sit out this battle as none of their concern, that they could not, like a certain president of the United States, dodge this draft with impunity. If they wanted to ignore this call to arms and stay down on their farms, they were putting themselves in harm's way, Saul let them know. For when it was all over, they would give account. The king would butcher their livestock like he had butchered his own if they neglected his command. Well, that got their attention big time, and the text says the fear of the Lord fell upon the people. And, as if individually they were one organism, they gathered at Bezek as one man. By the fear of the Lord is meant in this context the fear or dread prompted by the Lord in the breasts of the people. Well, consequently, 300,000 men of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, and 30,000 more from Judah, mustered at the appointed place, ready to take orders and do battle. We're not certain how long the assembling of this force took, but certainly inside the 7-day limit set by the Ammonite ruler. Well, once the army was present and help for the besieged people of Jabesh could be pledged, the messengers of the embattled city were authorized to report to city authorities that the next day, by the time the sun was hot, deliverance would be theirs. Naturally, that message was received in the city of Jabesh with great jubilation. Saul is about to show some tactical smarts as a field general. That's all part of the Lord changing his personality. And he is about to take the overconfident Ammonites by complete surprise. What he will do is position his army during the night to be ready to launch an attack early the next morning, before the Ammonites had the sleepers out of their eyes. To enhance the element of surprise, we see in verse 10, the men of Jabesh, in collusion with Saul, decided upon a ruse. With their 7-day reprieve about to expire, they notified the Ammonites of their intent to surrender. To come out is deliberately ambiguous and intentionally misleading, and to tell the Ammonites that they were ready to take whatever punishment their enemies saw fit to inflict on them. That, of course, caused the Ammonites to let down their guard and be unprepared for battle the next morning when the Israelite army suddenly appeared out of nowhere. So in verse 11, Saul divided his troops into three companies or divisions. Then at the morning watch, around 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., the Israelites staged an unexpected attack from three directions. The Ammonite force was totally surprised and completely unprepared for the assault. The slaughter continued up until the morning until the sun was hot, an expression which we reckon to indicate high noon. The only remnant of the Ammonite army was lonely stragglers trying to escape the battlefield. The decimation was so complete, we read, that no two of them were left alone. God, in his providence, used the aggression of the Ammonites as a window of opportunity to bestow upon Saul, through a resounding military exploit, the credibility that Saul required as their leader and king. Having shamed his rebellious detractors by his first heroics as their military commander and in making war on the Ammonites, when Saul returned from battle, his supporters, still stinging from the reproaches hurled at Saul and his followers as well, they wanted to exterminate the rebel insulters that we saw in 1 Samuel 10:27. Saul, however, flush with the joy of victory and his newfound credibility as king in the eyes of the nation, no longer sensed any political threat owing to their rejection of him as ruler. So he was inclined to be merciful. He did not want a day of celebration to be commingled with a time of lamentation over the death of his enemies, which reminds us that sadness and gladness do not mix well together. Celebration and lamentation do not belong in the same room. There is a time for severity, and there is a time for mercy. Triumph had trashed the threat Saul's detractors posed. So in this case, mercy was affordable. So Samuel seized the moment to renew the kingship. Saul already had been crowned, but you know something? A crown does not impart credibility. You can give a man an office of leadership, but the office does not make him a leader. Now that Saul had validated his right to be king, Samuel wanted Israel to reassemble and to reaffirm the king emotionally. They had done it formally before, but now Samuel was wise enough to want Israel to reassemble and to confirm the king emotionally. God gave Saul the honor to be the king of Israel. Now, God gave him the support to be their king. That is quite a story, and in our next study, I will share with you illustrations of the unseen hand of God in human events based upon this narrative. Thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.